Hello, and welcome to the latest episode of the Minorities in Publishing podcast. For new and returning listeners, you may know this is Jen. You can find the podcast on Tumblr at minoritiesinpublishing.tumblr.com or on Twitter at minoritiesinpub, where you can also subscribe to the newsletter at the pinned tweet. I am, as always, super enthusiastic to have today's guest on, and we are still doing this during a pandemic, so hopefully that will be over soon. But what is over when it comes to pandemics? I don't know. Mike Sakasagawa, he is a writer, a fellow podcaster, and a photographer, and we're going to talk about this literary podcast life. So I'm really happy to have you on because I haven't had any fellow podcasters on.
It's always a lot of fun. I always find it a little intimidating, but also a little fun to talk to other podcasters.
I'm going on about 6 years running. It'll probably be 6 years on the dot by the time this episode airs, and I'm still learning all the time. So anyone who's listened through the progression of 6 years has seen the audio has gotten quite impressive over the years. So how long have you been podcasting, Mike?
It's been 4 years, a little over 4 years. I started in January of 2016 with my first show, and is my main show, is Keep the Channel Open. And it's a series of conversations with artists and writers and creative people working in all different disciplines. And it's been, like you were saying, it's been a lot of sort of on the job training and sort of figuring things out as I go. It's always an interesting challenge to try and figure out how to get to the sort of next level of podcasting skills. But yeah, it's been a lot of fun doing it.
So can you talk about, because you do two different forms of podcasts too. So one is a storytelling and the other is interview format. Is that accurate?
Yeah, that's right. Yeah. So like I said, I have two shows. Keep the Channel Open is my main show. And that one's been ongoing. It comes out every other week. And it's sort of long form, intimate conversations. I don't like to think of them as interviews as much as I like to think of them as conversations, talking with all different kinds of artists and creative people. And then the other one, as you mentioned, is a storytelling podcast, and it's called Likewise Fiction. And I launched that one in October of last year, 2019, and just finished up the first season in April. So it's a show where I'm reading short stories that are written by women, non-binary authors, authors of color, and LGBTQIA authors. And as you might guess, it's a pretty different process with each show. Being focused on conversation, it's very sort of spontaneous and in the moment. And I structure my show to try and capture as much of that real conversational spirit as possible. So I never really know how it's going to go until after it's done. Whereas with Likewise Fiction, because it's a storytelling podcast, it's a lot heavier on production. I don't have to bring guests in. So you know, on the one hand, that makes things a little simpler and easier to expect, but it's been an interesting challenge because you have to deal with scoring and you have to deal with sound effects and just trying to figure out the best possible way to bring these stories to life. I'm using all the different production tricks that I've managed to figure out over the last 4 years. It was a really neat challenge, and I really feel grateful to have gotten to work with so many really wonderful authors on that.
And there is that complexity, like you were saying, when it comes to a storytelling format, because you are fully immersing people in what is happening for the most part. Mm-hmm. And you mentioned scoring. There is a reason I don't have an intro for this podcast. I don't have the time or interest in sinking that in. But that is kind of a big endeavor. And at the same time, I wonder if we talk enough about the storytelling podcasts. Because they are a valid form of publication. I've had a story that was primarily in a storytelling podcast. And it seems like another avenue for marginalized voices overall to get their work, not just out there, but really for people to hear it and understand it and feel it in a way that, you know, I think sometimes we don't always see on the page.
Yeah, this was really sort of central to the project of Likewise Fiction for me, is really being aware of, just in general, how for marginalized writers, there just aren't that many venues for these voices, and how, you know, among traditional publishing outlets, writers of color, for example, make up a small minority of all of the stories that are published, queer voices, even women's voices. Like, I think a lot of people might be surprised, but like there are groups like Vita that have done counts of how many women are being published versus how many men in a bunch of different publications. And it's, I think, only recently, like only last year, they might have had a count where some of the publications were like even, but you know, most of the time it's not. And so being mindful of how much more difficult it is for marginalized writers to get their work out there, I wanted to start up my show as a new venue, and especially a paying venue to support these artists' work. And it was also important to me to include writers at different stages of their career. So I have some authors that I worked with this season, Celeste Ng, for example, who is, you know, very well-established and a very well-known writer. And then I had other writers like Alvin Park, for example, who is sort of more of an emerging writer and who I think is just an outstanding writer. And I love everything I've read by him. So it's like I was equally pleased to get to work with both of them. And storytelling as a podcast format is an interesting one to me because, you know, as an audio format, I think there's a lot you can do in the performance of a story that it gives you new avenues to explore besides just the written word and what's on the page, and figuring out how to bring different qualities to light in these different stories was an interesting challenge. And I, you know, I hope I did okay at it, but it was fun. It was definitely a learning experience. It's been really interesting to see audio fiction is a genre of podcasting that has really exploded in the last few years, but I think is still under the radar for a lot of the listening public. But even at that, in the research that I did, the sort of market research I did coming into this project, most of the audio fiction shows that I was able to find, and there are, you know, hundreds of them, but most of them, the overwhelming majority of them, are audio dramas, which, you know, like what you might think of like an old time radio drama, but new and, you know, much more contemporary and bringing in a lot of new styles and voices. And there's like great stuff happening in the audio drama space. But storytelling, I feel like there are other podcasts for sure that are great, that are doing storytelling, like all of the different Escape Artists podcasts are wonderful. And obviously LeVar Burton Reads is outstanding. You know, we're all a little bit in his shadow. The New Yorker has some storytelling podcasts that are good, but they're just weren't as many of them. And I found that really interesting because I really do feel like storytelling, out loud performances of stories are such a part of the literary world. You know, we all go to readings, we're going to maybe go to poetry readings, or we go to, you know, readings when there's a book launch or stuff like that. And it just doesn't seem like there are quite as many of these podcasts. It seemed like a real opportunity. And yeah, I wanted to see what I could do within that space.
Can I also give a shout out, because I'm noticing that you also have transcripts for the Keep the Channel Open podcast? Yeah. You know, a lot of people don't do that. I do it. I'm not noticing a lot of people doing that.
Yeah, I have it as a goal to try and get, and maybe not all the way through my backlog, but make it significant dent in my backlog. I didn't always have transcripts for Keep the Channel Open. I think a couple of years in, I started hearing about how for people who are hard of hearing, that having an audio only format, you know, it's not accessible. And wanting to be able to serve different audiences well is important to me, making the shows as inclusive as possible, whether that's through who I'm inviting on the show or what formats I'm making the material available in, is important to me. You know, I feel like it's important to be a good literary citizen, a good podcast citizen. Yeah. So I started doing the transcripts a couple of years ago, and I'm sort of slowly working my way on through my backlog to try and get the whole archive transcribed, but it is a lot of work.
Oh, I hear you. I hear you, because I'm still going through my backlog too. So I have been in a similar position of the first 3 years, I think, of the podcast. I did not have it, and then subsequently have. So I think I'm at the halfway mark at least. It's like 50-50. Mm-hmm. But yeah, it means like I have transcripts I paid people to do and haven't reviewed yet to post. I have a dozen of those. And then there are other ones I have yet to post as well. So, but it's part of the time, effort, and cost that goes into podcasting. And I'm not trying to start a new drama, obviously. But having another podcaster on, it seems even more relevant to talk about the labor involved in this. Because it's a literary endeavor, it's audio, yes, it's media, yes, but we are celebrating writers in mm-hmm. different formats, whether we're speaking to publishing professionals or the writers themselves or creating a whole vibe for their work. This is so much energy. It takes me potentially hours to edit an episode. especially if it's an hour long or goes longer. That's like several hours of my weekend editing a podcast. Money, like I told you before, I hit record, hiring someone to help me smooth out the audio because I don't have the time because I have six other episodes to worry about. Paying someone to do transcripts, doing the transcripts yourself, doing the scoring, like you said, looking at submissions or pursuing guests. All these things are hours, hours of time. So it becomes a labor of love, just like quote unquote writing is. But I think there's another level to this because we're forward facing, or I should say we're front facing for the podcast, even though you're not seeing our faces, but you're hearing our voices, and we're producing something pretty consecutively and consistently. Yeah. So can you talk a little bit about the stages of that pursuit of getting funding, figuring out how the podcast is going to look, figuring out the mechanics? Because that's another thing that a lot of people, what it makes people hesitate to do a podcast, or it makes everyone think they can do it because, oh, I can record from my phone. And then I'm like, the quality, no, the quality. Like, don't do that. Invest in the materials. But, you know, people don't have the money, or they think it's just so easy to have cool conversations when the end experience for the listener is really important.
Yeah. I mean, I think it is something that people talk about all the time, how easy it is to get into podcasting. And that is, in a certain sense, it's very true. Like, anybody can make a podcast, and you can do it on your phone, and you can do all of these things, but you're not necessarily, if you're just jumping in with no plan, no idea what you're doing, you're not necessarily going to be making great content that people really want to listen to. I know that, I mean, even myself, I was a little bit guilty of this when I first started, didn't really know what I was doing. And definitely the first few episodes were a lot rougher and less polished than what I'm able to do now.
Co-sign that. Relatable.
I mean, then the learning here was like me, and I think it sounds like for you, where we really are like a truly independent podcast where I'm the host, I'm on the mic and I'm talking to people, but I'm also, I'm doing every aspect. I'm doing the pre-planning, the post-processing, I'm doing everything myself. And I think I have nothing but respect for these podcasts that can have big staffs and big budgets and stuff like that. And I think that there are some really great shows out there that are doing things that I couldn't think about taking on, but being able to make the most out of a staff of one and a very limited budget, it's got its challenges and its rewards. The things that you were talking about, like my processes for the two shows, it's interesting. We're actually pretty different. I really thought going into Likewise Fiction that it was going to be easy because I thought, well, you know, the material is already written and like, I don't have to do any booking and I don't have to do anything like that. And I don't have to do research or anything like that, but it turned out.
And then you press record and it all came together, right?
I knew there was going to be post-processing involved. I knew that doing all of that was going to be work, but I didn't quite realize how much work it was going to be. To give you an idea with Keep the Channel Open, that show, I am sending out queries regularly. I probably send out 2 to 3 queries a week, maybe more. So depending on, you know, how much reading I'm able to get done, because I never invite somebody on the show unless the work makes me think I could have a good conversation about it. So I have to read everything first. So, you know, I send out queries. I also get people who are querying me to be on the show. And so I'm doing a ton of just background reading and research and looking around at, you know, artists' websites and seeing what my artist friends are talking about. So I can't even include how much time goes into that because I don't keep track of it. It's just kind of something that's constantly going on. But then booking a guest takes a certain amount of time. There's a certain amount of back and forth with that. Once I know that I'm going to have an appointment scheduled to talk with someone for the show, I'll usually spend maybe 10, 20 sometimes hours doing research in their work, listening to all the other podcasts they've been on, reading all the interviews they've done recently, figuring out what I want to talk about. I don't use a set question list, but every time I talk to someone for Keep the Channel Open, I'll have about 5 to 10 pages of notes of different things that I could talk about or that we could talk about, and then just sort of see what happens. And part of that for me is that I feel like these people are doing me such a great favor of having these wonderful conversations with me. The least I can do is be really prepared and really pay close, deep attention to the work that they have done and the conversations that they have had about that work to try and make it an enjoyable conversation for them as well. But then there's that. The recording usually takes about an hour and a half. That's the shortest portion of the whole process. And then the post-processing and post-processing transcription, all of the different little logistical things, posting things to different websites and hosting servers, takes about probably another 8 to 10 hours per episode as well. And all of that on top of the fact that I do have a full-time job and 3 kids. With Likewise Fiction, I started logging my hours for that. And it turned out that I was putting in at least 20 hours a week on that one, on top of having another show and all of that other stuff. And
whoa, 20 hours?
And this is for a bi-weekly release schedule. So I was only releasing them every other week.
Bi-weekly? Seems, I mean, for the first 3+ years of this podcast, I was doing bi-weekly, but I can't imagine doing 2 podcasts. And one is bi-weekly or both are bi-weekly?
They were both bi-weekly.
Oh my gosh, Mike.
On opposite weeks.
Mike, no.
That one with Likewise Fiction, because I'm working with authors and because I'm working, you know, with stories that have already been published, you know, first there's finding all of the stories that I want to work with. And then there's reaching out to people either directly or if they have agents, I'm reaching out to their agents and like working out contract details. And so it might take some of the stories took several months to get to the point where we had a signed contract and figuring that out. And then of course that involved a lot of background work with my own, finding an attorney who could help me draw up contracts, and then doing all the different contract negotiations, which sometimes were very detailed. But then once getting to the point where I actually wanted to record, let's say I have a 5,000 word story that I'm recording, that's going to wind up being maybe 40 minutes or so in the final edit. But recording it, because I need to make sure I get every word exactly perfect and exactly performed the way that I want it to sound, is going to take me maybe 4 hours or so to do. And then the actual process of post-production, that's where the bulk of the work would happen, because I have to figure out what music I want to use. And of course, I have to license that music as well. So that's also a whole process. But just figuring out, like, I have to find a song that doesn't have lyrics that is available for me to use. And it has to be exactly the right length, or at least long enough that I can cut it down. And it has to have exactly the right tone and emotion to support the work, but not be overwhelming and not drown it out. Things like that. Going through and finding little sound effect clips that I can use, and figuring out the sort of subtle mixing to, again, allow it to support the work but not be distracting. And it's, you know, you spend so much time on the tiniest little edits, just moving something a quarter of a second or an eighth of a second to make sure that it sounds exactly right, that every pause is exactly perfect. And a lot of work goes into it. So that 20 hours a week was, you end up spending a lot more time on it than maybe you realize by the time it's all said and done. But hopefully it's all in service of getting an episode that is as close to perfect as I can make it. And again, I think that's something that's like, you know, these authors, you know, they don't have to work with me. All of these stories were published elsewhere already, so they don't have to pick me. And so because they are working with me, I want to make sure that I am doing everything I can to support their work, support them, and show their work in the best possible light. And I feel like that's my job as the podcaster.
I've never timed myself for the MIP podcast. I do know that it probably takes, if I'm editing an hour plus long episode, the audio sucks. and someone says like a lot, potentially, or, you know, those types of things. You're also editing out the breaths, those just idiosyncrasies that come up, and then reviewing the transcript, building the newsletter. And I would say if I'm on the ball and I don't go off on Twitter and stuff like that, maybe that's 7, 8, 9, 10 hours on top of doing the social media or MIP, which I was much better at in the beginning stages than I am now. And so you put all that together, and this unpaid labor and the professionalism too, because you're talking about legalese and contracts and stuff. I don't even get into that because I don't do the fiction part. I don't do the storytelling part. It's, you know, sifting through the requests. And I can only imagine the type of request you're getting when you do 2 formats, because I get some doozies. And all I do is interview or also have conversations. And so it's nice to talk to someone to kind of demystify if this is misty to people, because I really do think people don't get that to produce a successful podcast and a professional podcast is putting so many hours into it. And I also don't have sponsors. There's a reason I don't have sponsors. Potentially, maybe there could be partnerships. I don't know if you wanted to pursue that. But I'm kind of hesitant about that because I love Book Riot. They do great work there. But listening to their podcast, and it's just, we're going to talk about a segment. Okay, here's a note from our sponsor. And then it's like, this book about she loves him, but he doesn't love her. And oh my gosh, what is going to happen? Da 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 da. Comes out August 15th from Penguin Random House. Okay, we're back. I was like, that is not the flow and vibe I'm trying to get with this podcast, even though I like money a lot. Yeah. So it's interesting to hear that you're spending even more hours on it. And do you think you're going to do a step back at all? Or do you do seasons so that at least it's like, okay, I'm doing 6 months on, 6 months off, or 9 months on, 3 months off, or something like that, just to give yourself more time to do what you need to do, because you also have kids.
Yeah, I like to describe myself as always tired.
Also relatable.
Also relatable. Yeah. So Keep the Channel Open is just something that is sort of ongoing. I've lately, starting last year, I decided that I would take the last 6 weeks of the year off and only release reruns. And occasionally, I have a deep enough backlog now archived that I can do reruns when I need to. Occasionally, I do run out of people to talk to and I have to put out a rerun episode. But yeah, at the end of the year, I like to take some time off. Other than that, I don't really do seasons, and it's just sort of a constant hustle of booking new guests and doing all of that work and cranking out a new episode every other week. With Likewise Fiction, because of the fact that I wanted to be a paying venue. I didn't want to be, because we all know how awful it is, the whole like, oh, it'll be great exposure kind of thing. That's bullshit.
I love that you're just like, no.
I love these authors. I love their work. And I believe that they deserve to be paid for the work that they've done. So because I'm not independently wealthy, as much as I might enjoy that, I had to go out and find money where I could. So part of it is self-funded. Part of it is, I went out and found some local foundations that could donate a little bit here, some local businesses that could donate a little bit there, that kind of thing. And, even at that, I didn't raise as much money as I ended up spending on it, which fortunately I do have a day job that allows me to have a little extra money to pay for things like that. But the whole question of sponsorship is a really interesting one, and sponsorship and partnerships, because you do sort of give up a certain amount of creative freedom in these things, but then at least ostensibly you're getting more resources. I think that there are some podcast networks that seem to do really, really great work. Like even in the literary space, I've noticed that LitHub recently added a bunch of new podcasts to their network, some of which I really like, like my friend Courtney Ballastier, her show WMFA got recently added to LitHub's podcast network. And she's great. Her show is fantastic. I love listening to it. We did a show swap a year or two ago, and that was a lot of fun. That kind of thing can really help you in terms of building an audience, cross promotion, stuff like that. But, like you say, you can give up something. I think it depends a lot on the specific people that you're working with, the specific network that you're joining. Some of them are really great. Courtney's show, she added a little bumper at the end, like mentioning that it's in it, but the rest of the show sounds like it always has. And so that's really great. Other ones, like you say, can be a little more intrusive. And, especially if you've been doing it yourself for a while, you sort of have a way that you like your show to sound. And giving that up is something that I think you do have to kind of think about seriously.
Yeah, there are just so many avenues that can be taken into account. What I found, and this is something I receive, especially when people pitch series to Electric Literature, is that everyone really likes the idea of it, right? And then the work comes in. I think it's similar to writing itself, because that's the type of pitches I get too. And Meredith Talusan, who's a wonderful, wonderful editor in person, she talked about that too on Twitter, of people have great ideas. And then it's like, well, can you flesh that out a little bit? Or can you actually make that da-da-da-da-da. And it's like, oh God, this is a lot of work. So sometimes those partnerships in some instances can be seen as kind of a crutch of, well, I'm not going to do it unless I get paid. But you're also finding a way to pay people, because I see you said like you have the sponsorships, you have patrons and all that stuff. So that's an avenue people can go to. I pay for everything myself because, yeah, I just do. And it's a tax write-off. Like, everything's a tax write-off, as far as I'm concerned. But it is a service at the same time that you're doing. Because you're not getting paid necessarily.
Yeah. The sponsorships and sort of institutional support that I was able to get for Likewise Fiction made up about half of the money that the show cost to produce. And with Keep the Channel Open, do have a Patreon, for example, and that helps defray some of the costs. It doesn't pay for everything. So it's not, I think one thing that a lot of people have a lot of misconceptions about is that, one, that podcasting is easy, but also that it is like a pathway to fame and fortune easily. And people have that with all kinds of things. Like, people think that about being a writer. People think that about being an artist.
And yeah, YouTubers. Everyone thought that. Yeah. And then that article came out. It was like, actually, we don't make that much money. It was like, yeah. Oh.
With any of these things, it's like, you know, not every writer is going to wind up being Stephen King or Danielle Steele. Even the ones that are like really critically acclaimed sometimes aren't the ones making a ton of money. Not every podcaster is going to be getting a million downloads and huge sponsorship numbers. It's an interesting wake-up call, I think, for a lot of people. Something that a lot of people don't even know is like, what is normal for a podcast? The hosting service that I use, Libsyn, put out some numbers, I think, a year or so ago, where they were saying that the average number of downloads that a podcast episode gets is about 150. And if you're putting in 10, 20 plus hours a week to just be reaching 150 people, like, at a certain point, you got to kind of say to yourself, well, like, you know, is that worth it to me? And for some people, it is. For some people, it's like, yeah, that's great. But if you're thinking that it's going to be something that's really easy and you just have to get two of your buddies in a room and not have a plan and just start talking and not edit it and not even have microphones, that might not get you past that 150 downloads. I might even get you to it. So it's a lot more work, and it can be, at least in sort of a material sense, less payoff than what some people might expect.
And that circles back to the labor of love, of what it is. Because even with writing, I don't know, there's just something about podcasting, man. But the thing is, we see a result. Whereas with my writing, and you're a writer, you also do photography. So I'm curious your opinion on this. With my writing, it could take years before I get a really good product. And then I'm like, this is a damn good product. I finally found a home for it after 8 years. And even with the podcast, the product is consistently there and I'm very proud of it. But sometimes I'm like, oh man, I gotta keep doing this. like even now, I'm like, I'm gonna be done editing one episode, and I know there are four more that I gotta do. And it's not arduous. It's just, I don't know. There's just something, there's this difference I can't quite put my finger on, even though one produces an actual result that we consistently see, especially since, depending on how we choose to make it consistent.
I mean, I think that with any creative endeavor, you kind of have to figure out for yourself what your parameters for success are. If, as a writer, your parameter for success is like, I'm making, you know, enough money to support myself without a day job, that's, you know, for a lot of people, that can be very difficult to reach. I mean, a lot of writers, even ones that you think of as successful, actually still have day jobs and then need that. Same thing with podcasting. The number of people who can support themselves entirely based on podcasting is very, very small. For me, I don't make enough money off of my shows to do more than like continue making the shows. But for me, that's kind of enough. And what has been really amazing is getting to, one, have the conversations or be able to make these stories into an audio form. Just having that to look back on is pretty amazing. And then the other thing too is in the community aspect of it. I've gotten to meet a lot of writers, a lot of artists, some of whom I've gone on to become friends with. And besides that, I've gotten to meet and talk with and sort of shop talk or whatever with a lot of different podcasters, some of whom I've gone on to become friends with. And that community, I think, is really valuable. And it also, it's nice. One thing about, like, if you're a writer, having writer friends, or if you're a photographer, having photographer friends, or if you're a podcaster, having podcaster friends, is like, there are times when you can feel like you're really spinning your wheels. You know, you don't necessarily know if what you're doing is any good. You, of course, do have to figure that out for yourself. You can't really rely on other people entirely to say whether or not what you're doing is any good. But it is nice that once you have that community that you know that like these people know what they're talking about. So if they say something nice, and especially if they say something specific and nice about the work that you're doing, that can be a real nice ego boost. It can really get you through the day, or at least through the next episode. And it's been very rewarding to me to get to sort of learn from, but also be a resource to other podcasters. At AWP this year, I was supposed to moderate a panel all about the literary podcast interview and what goes into a good interview, that kind of thing. And I was scheduled to be talking with David Naiman of Between the Covers, Rachel Zucker of Commonplace, and Duji Tahat of The Poet Salon, which are all shows that I love. And then, of course, because of the virus, we ended up canceling it. But then I got to do it as a remote thing. We set up a Zoom call and the four of us got on and we had a really great conversation that I ended up releasing as my 108th episode. That was a month ago, I think. And it was just getting to sort of form that relationship with these podcasters whose shows I admire so much, and getting to talk to them and sort of pick their brains about those things. But also, you know, they had questions for me that I could answer for them. That's having that kind of a back and forth relationship. It's really meaningful, I think. And it's the kind of thing that, again, you know, it can get you through the next episode.
This is true. We're both committed. That's what matters. We're both very committed to our craft. Crafts. Yeah. Plural. So, Mike, how can people reach out to you, become patrons for your podcast, listen to your podcast if they're not already? Please give us the info.
Yeah, well, both podcasts are available wherever you can find podcasts. Keep the Channel Open and Likewise Fiction. You can search for either of those in just about any podcast app and it'll come up. Keep the Channel Open is at keepthechannelopen.com and Likewise Fiction is at likewisefiction.com for the websites. You can find me personally on Twitter at Sake River. That's sake like the drink and river like river is how I always like to say it. And if someone does want to join my Patreon, that is patreon.com/likewisemedia. And I'm always grateful for all of the support. I'm always grateful just to be able to have conversations with listeners too. Something that I think a lot of people don't realize is that a nice interaction with your audience, whether that's something like an email or even just something as simple as a tweet that says, hey, I really liked this episode, that can really make your day. And it's something that I always really encourage everyone to do. If there is a book or a podcast or a short story or an essay or anything that you read or that you experienced and it mattered to you, like, just, you know, reach out, tell that person, find them on Twitter, send them an email. It really can make a big difference.
I appreciate all the work that you're doing, Mike, especially to make your podcast accessible, pay writers, look out for marginalized artists. So thank you for everything that you're doing. And I really hope you're getting sleep and time for yourself out of that 20 hours, or the 20 hours has gone down a little bit, and get an intern or something.
I appreciate the work that you do as well. This show is really great. It's really great to get to see other people of color working in publishing, in literature, all of this thing, and like getting to hear these experiences on your show. I think it's really valuable. So thank you for all the work that you do.
Yay, mutual appreciation society. every time. That's what keeps me going, is the warm fuzzies every episode. Mutual respect. So thank you again, Mike Sakasagawa. And again, it's at SAKERIVER on the Twitter. Yeah.
Yep.
And .com. You add the .com on that for your website.
Yeah,
and you
link my personal website.
All that good stuff. So thank you again, Mike.
Thank you.
And thanks to everyone listening. And if you're going to do a podcast now, you know the labor involved. So. But I highly encourage you to do your thing and also subscribe to Likewise Fiction and keep the channel open as well. So take care, everybody, and hope you're staying safe amidst all of this, what's going on.